Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome back to iGen Politics. This is a podcast that makes politics engaging and relevant for all generations. My name is Victor Shi. I'm currently a sophomore at UCLA, was elected as the youngest delegate for Joe Biden, and I'm one of the co-hosts of this podcast.
I'm Jill Wine Banks, the author of The Watergate Girl, based on my experiences during the Watergate trial. I'm also the wearer of Jill's pins, and today's pins are in honor of our special guest. I'm wearing a United States Army pin on the top with a flag. And I'm also wearing a Ukrainian Pinocchio pin because our guest today has identified many Pinocchios from the former president. So it seemed totally appropriate to me to be wearing that.
Against the backdrop of slow chipping away of fundamental rights across the country, it's imperative that elected officials, public servants, and yes, young people and average voters to speak up and let their bosses, teachers, or elected officials know what's at risk and to do it based on solid knowledge and facts. But how does one do so when there's so much disinformation and polarization in our country?
We have the perfect guest for that. There is no one to better represent the value of speaking up based on knowledge than our guest today, retired Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. You no doubt recognize him from his powerful testimony during then-President Donald Trump's first impeachment hearing, which we will ask him about today. Colonel Vindman is also the author of the brand new book, Here Right Matters, An American Story, about his life and the consequences of his testimony. We'll talk to him about that too. Previously, Colonel Vindman served as Director of European Affairs on the White House National Security Council. He also worked at the Pentagon for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was a foreign area officer at U.S. embassies in Ukraine and in Russia. Currently, Colonel Vindman is a doctoral student and a Foreign Policy Institute fellow at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He is also a Pritzker Military Fellow at the Lawfare Institute, and I want to mention, of course, that the Pritzker Military Museum is right here in Chicago, and those of you who haven't seen it, you really must visit. It is a wonderful, interesting place. So anyway, he is also a board member of the Renew Democracy Initiative and is a visiting fellow at the University of Pennsylvania's Perry World House. He's obviously quite busy, so we're very honored to have you with us today, Colonel Vindman. We thank you very much for this time.
Well, thank you, Victor. Thank you, Jill. I'm looking forward to this conversation. Always welcome the opportunity to talk to folks from the Chicago area, just because I think Chicago has been particularly hospitable to me. Glad to discuss all these things.
Thank you.
Likewise. Yeah, so let's get right into it. So what really struck me about your book is just how you thread the needle from what you learned during your childhood, from your father's example, and your army training and experiences to your testimony during former President Trump's first impeachment hearing. So I'm wondering if you can talk more about some of those key lessons that you learned and how they shaped your actions in reporting what you saw as President Trump's wrongdoing.
Sure. So, you know, it's interesting that this is the reason I settled on this approach to memoirs, because there were a lot of questions as to why, you know, or how. How did a army officer challenge the commander-in-chief, the most powerful man in the world, and why? And I thought that there was an opportunity to kind of illuminate, you know, that in this country, that's actually okay. That's appropriate. If the president is doing something unlawful, he's not above the law. And that was my that answered fundamentally the why, you know, how I see this country based on perspective, living overseas, coming to this country as a refugee, but also after that, living overseas in South Korea, deploying to Iraq, Ukraine, Germany, Russia, and seeing a lot of places where right just didn't matter, where the powerful were above the law. And then so answering the question of why, how seemed like the next question to answer. And I think it was what I tried to do is pull together the various tools that I thought were instrumental in doing the right thing in the right way. So I'd say those were the key ones were my values that my dad first instilled in me, a couple decades of military service and effort to adhere to the Army values, loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, personal courage. And then if those were explicit, there were a bunch of implicit lessons I learned. You know, that we as a military and as a government tend to focus on the risks rather than understanding both the risks and there's a formula that we apply. It's called probability and consequence. We tend to focus on consequence without recognizing probability. And I pride myself on trying to calculate those out. So a more accurate assessment of risk. So that's another thing. I think my experience in Russia indicated that I had a good sense of, you know, how countries go down the slippery slope towards authoritarianism. At one point, Russia was moving in the direction of a democracy. You see it play out in Poland and in Turkey and Hungary. And I feared for the direction our country was going in with the erosion of institutions. So these are just a few of the areas that fed into my understanding of the situation and what I needed to do. And then really some concrete tools. Like I talk about navigation, how to navigate, you know, simply I talk about it from a terrain perspective, but there was also navigating, you know, perilous moments. I talk about this idea of trying to speak truth to power. We call it not walking by a mistake. You know, this is something that I've been encouraged to do throughout my military career. In a lot of ways, I think, you know, all of these pieces came together in a way that allowed me to really meet some unprecedented challenges where there were no templates, there was no really good advice, and then kind of take my own counsel to a certain extent on what to do next.
I have to say, I forgot to mention that I was general counsel of the Army during the Carter administration. And I came to see the training that Army officers get and how the analytic skills of those people are. And so I was particularly interested in reading your book about not just your childhood and the lessons of your father, but how you took the lessons of an infantry officer. And then later, and we'll talk more about this too, your training to be a foreign area officer, to work in foreign policy, really. Not just on the ground as an infantry officer, but we want our audience to get to know you. So I want to briefly mention that you start your book, of course, talking about after you came to America from Ukraine. You vividly describe a very adventurous childhood in Brooklyn. You and your twin brother got into quite a lot of mischief, I'd say. You describe yourself as a late bloomer, and not focusing on school, but you did end up, despite that, receiving a full scholarship to American University. Unfortunately, in your book, you described that you still didn't focus on school, and you chose to focus more on ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps program at the school, and so you ended up being dismissed from American University after three semesters. And because I don't think that everybody knows even what ROTC is, it might be good to describe, one, whether you think you made a mistake in your priorities in terms of education academics and staying at AU, or whether ROTC ended up being the best path to your career?
You know, it's interesting. I think it's hard to rationalize changing any of these individual components, because all of them combined to make me who I am. You know, if I had not kind of flunked out of school because I, you know, just I couldn't probably in certain regards just couldn't sit still, couldn't sit through like, you know, a lecture seminar or something like that and stay focused. It's just I needed to, and that's why in certain ways I prioritized ROTCs, because it was very physical and athletic, and it was a good way for me to expend some of the excess energy. Maybe in certain regards too much energy, because I didn't have any energy for classes. But I think, you know, it's kind of interesting. First answer is, of course, I made enormous mistakes. Yeah. I should not have, you know, kind of discounted my education. I should have not been kind of unfocused. In certain ways, I was probably unprepared for some of the freedoms of going into university, you know, from being kind of somewhat of a insular, introverted guy in high school and stuff like that. And all that freedom may have possibly been a little bit too much for me at that point in time. You know, I couldn't afford a gap year. We didn't have gap years back then, I don't think. So that probably would have served me well. But of course, I made some significant mistakes, but there are also mistakes that I learned from. I think because of that, I forced myself at a time where academics weren't actually that hard for me. They weren't that hard for me in undergrad. They weren't that hard for me in high school. They weren't that hard for me. It just I really like put no effort in whatsoever. But I just forced myself to stay focused and completed my undergraduate. And I also kind of recognized that I set myself back, you know, on my heels in a major way. And at that point, you know, I worked extra hard as a military officer. You know, much harder. Let's say much harder than it would take to be a successful college student in a lot of ways. And then set my bar to go to Harvard for master's, and now I'm at Johns Hopkins. So I overcame some of those deficiencies and learned from my mistakes. But obviously, it didn't have to be that way. It could have made my life a heck of a lot easier. But then I don't know. I wouldn't have had those adverse experiences, and you know, there would have been all sorts of other decisions along the way that would have changed, like the ripple effect, I guess, or the butterfly effect.
Or when you get lemons, make lemonade, which you did, and you graduated from State University of New York at Binghamton. Go ahead, Victor. You had some questions.
I'll be going back there, actually. I just let them know today. They asked me to speak at homecoming, so this will be my first trip back.
Oh, fantastic.
So I guess I did something. I pulled a rabbit out of a hat somewhere along the way.
Well, I know this is perfect advice for college students like me. You know, I think this notion of making mistake, learning from them, and then using that as something that you can carry with you your entire life. But right after college, you completed an infantry course basic training, served in South Korea, Germany, and Iraq, where you earned a Purple Heart. And you write a lot about the training that you received and the leadership lessons you learned during your time in the military, as well as observing officers. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how the military really shaped you?
Well, so again, it's through a combination of successes and failures. I was a pretty decent infantry officer. I mean, I knew my small unit tactics. I was creative. You know, I tried to understand not just what I needed to do with my platoon, but what my seniors were trying to do. So I think that made for a pretty decent infantry officer. Probably, I mean, not the best, far from the worst, but I was pretty good. And I think that's, I also talk about this Operation Cabbage Patch thing in Korea, where I roll over this, my driver rolls over this vehicle, and, you know, it takes a massive effort to extract it. And it was a bit of a... it was certainly a little humiliating, and I just kind of, you know, made a point to not let stuff like that happen anymore. There are these trust but verify is something that you could learn the easy way or the hard way. I learned it the hard way. I also learned a lot about navigating, which served me well as both an infantry officer, just, you know, not getting lost and keeping my bearings is what I talk about when I'm going through the impeachment. But, you know, it came in handy, let's say, when I was in on the border between Russia and Ukraine, and Russia's waging war against Ukraine and they're pushing equipment across the border. And I'm in a position where I could kind of observe some of these things unfold. So it's a skill that served me throughout my life. You know, there are, so those are maybe tangible lessons, but there are intangibles also about the importance of service is something that I think certainly I carried with me. I cherish my military experience and I advocate for now. I think it's important to understand that military service, state, federal, local, community service is all extremely important into achieving your own aspirations to become a better person. Because what you're doing is you're practicing something that's not centered and oriented on yourself. You're practicing something that's oriented externally on your community. And because there's no personal gain, you train yourself, frankly, to do the right thing, you know, because the stakes are a little bit different. And you do that repetitively and build what I refer to as muscle memory. And then as you face increasing challenges, you have something to fall back on. You know what the right thing is. With experience, you learn what the right way of managing different challenges are. And when you hit one of these, you know, inflection points, a critical challenge, you've actually built a history of dealing with challenges along the way, and it makes things a lot easier. And I think that's, in certain ways, again, unprecedented to be drawn into an impeachment, but I've dealt with challenges all along the way, you know, some successfully, some unsuccessfully, that allowed me to kind of figure out how to navigate something that's extremely perilous. And obviously in my case, even though I think I did it in the best way possible, had some significant personal costs.
So following up on what you're saying in terms of the skills you learned, and that includes one of the dramatic examples was to pay attention to the absence of the normal or the presence of the abnormal. But all of those skills seem to have served you well. They've been useful both on the battlefield and in your testimony and in your career when you were a military attaché. And so when you transitioned from the infantry to strategic policy roles, was there additional training that the Army provided? Because one of the things I want to point out for our audience that most people probably listening don't know is how important education is in the military, how important degrees are, that you don't get to be a higher ranked officer. You don't get to be a lieutenant colonel, a colonel, and certainly not a general without a minimum of a master's degree, and oftentimes much, much more than that. So I'm just would like you to talk about, in addition to the skills you learned for the battlefield, what else did they teach you so that you could go into basically foreign policy?
Yeah, you know, that's an excellent point, Jill. I'll tell you that the military as a whole invests enormous resources in education to develop well-rounded officers. And I think where we end up coming short is when we, you know, waive some of the broadening assignments, waive some of these educations for exceptionally good officers that we want to keep in the force and you know, avoid pulling him out to do this developmental education. In my case, of course, as an infantryman, I did airborne, I did, infantry officer basic course, which is for lieutenants, airborne school, ranger school, captain's career course, command and general staff college, which is for majors ready. And then in addition to all of that stuff, I did foreign area training. And those are not short programs. Those are like, you know, 6 month or year long commitments. So I just rattled off, of course, the airborne school is short and ranger school is relatively short, but the rest of them are pretty healthy commitments. And then as a foreign area officer, it's a 3.5 year pipeline. I what I ended up doing is when I got selected for that, I picked up a second language, so Ukrainian. I did it for almost a year to build on the fact that I had Russian skills, so more versatility in places that I could serve. Then I went to what's called in-region training. I received a pretty healthy budget to not just simply travel Eurasia, but to actually learn about the culture, learn about the defense enterprises, learn about the political military situations in those countries. And I had a chance to visit to really traverse from like not just the former Soviet space, for lack of a better word, but also to the areas of importance around it, like Poland, Turkey, China, as well as traveling to all the Commonwealth of Independent States. And then I got sent to graduate school to Harvard for a year and a half. And only after that did I get, more specialized training as an attaché. You go to an attaché course that allows you to understand how to be an effective, to effectively observe and report on the host country's military. Only after that did I go to my first assignment, which was pretty awesome. I went straight to Russia. It's not like the end of the career. I did it right at the beginning, which is a pretty fantastic opportunity because I had a chance to see the Russians, roll out a hybrid warfare doctrine and implement that with regards to Ukraine, wage war in Ukraine. And then after being assigned to the Pentagon, I was able to author the critical documents, the documents of record, the ones that are being used now to face the challenges of Russia as an aggressor, somebody that employs, hybrid warfare against the United States, for that matter. So, and then that's how I made it to the White House, because of I just had all these pretty awesome opportunities all along the way, one building on the other, to get to that point.
So you went from being a flunk out at AU to graduating, then going to Harvard, and
that's a little harsh, Jill.
Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, you ended up at Harvard, you ended up in the Pentagon first, and then at the White House. And when you were assigned to the Pentagon, you went right to the top. You went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then Trump was elected while you were there. And for those who don't know it, the Joint Chiefs of Staff is the highest level in the military, and it advises the president. So you were working on Russia policy, having just come from Russia and Ukraine, and you were working to improve relations. Did Trump's becoming president change U.S. policy or U.S. behavior? And I'm going to draw a distinction between what we did versus what the official policy was in asking that question.
That's a very, very useful distinction, because we did have a difference between the two. As a matter of fact, on paper, and up until below the chief executive level, we had a credible policy that would fit within the band of like normal foreign policy. You have a conservative, you have a liberal schools of thought on stuff, but it fit within that kind of normal range. We had a national security strategy that was developed in 2017. That was a pretty credible document that articulated a vision to advance U.S. national security. And really, where the disconnect occurred, it was really specifically with the chief executive. It was the chief executive that tended to, when he inserted himself, upend what could have been a policy that advanced U.S. national security interests. We saw that repeatedly. Ukraine was just kind of like, my firsthand experience with it, but he did that with regards to North Korea, and to no avail. He basically bought the North Korean regime years to continue to advance their nuclear program without any consequences, degraded our ability to deter, sufficiently deter. I mean, we're deterring them, don't get me wrong, but because we canceled a bunch of exercises, bilateral exercises between us and the Koreans, that we reduced our capabilities there. The same thing could be said about his policies with regards to China. In most cases, those tariffs had massive blowback on the U.S. and U.S. economy. So his administration, not him, managed to do something with that. They managed to reorient on the kind of their emerging threat that China potentially poses, that China poses to the United States, and make gravy out of it. And the same thing happened with regards to the Russia policy. You know, the president wanted to engage with Vladimir Putin and at least provided a little bit of opportunity for the rest of the interagency to levy sanctions and consolidate kind of multilateral activities to push back on Russian aggression. But it's, again, in all, every case, it was the president himself that tended to be to upend the way we were, a deliberate, you know, crafted, reasoned foreign policy.
So basically what you're saying is that he was not following the advice of the professionals that was coming from the Joint Chiefs of Staff while you were there.
Well, it's not even that, actually. You know, he was not willing to hear the advice too often, or not willing to learn. You know, I would describe it as Trump probably didn't know any more on his last day in office than he did on his first day in office. He was just not somebody willing to learn. And, you know, that's different than taking the advice. A chief executive has every authority to kind of weigh the inputs he's receiving and come up with a value, with a decision. That's why he gets paid the big bucks. But that's not what he was doing. He was acting too often out of instinct and, you know, a lack of counsel, or as he did in the case of Ukraine, for self-service, for personal gain. That was, you know, the major issue with Donald Trump, and really as with his administration as time progressed, because all those folks that were initially in positions, you know, that we called as guardrails or qualified professionals, you know, slowly disappeared. You had second and third stringers come in and were able to provide less capable advice and less, you know, with less gravitas. Mm-hmm. So that's why things, you know, progressively got worse. Could you imagine what another 4 years would have been like? It would have been a disaster.
Yeah. So while serving in the Pentagon, you interviewed with one of our previous guests, Fiona Hill, and transitioned to serve on the White House National Security Council staff with her team. You started with a focus on Russia, but then your portfolio was broadened to include Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. Why was that?
Okay. That's funny. By the way, her book is coming out here shortly, so and I'm personally really excited to see it. I came there because of my deep Russia background. Mm-hmm. What ended up happening is that there was a lack of staffing, and I had some requisite skills, including the fact that I had lived and served in Ukraine, and I had learned the Ukraine language, that she thought that that I could fill that role. In addition to that, she also recognized that there was just not as much to do on the Russia portfolio that she had hired me for, because the president was not going to allow a very kind of forward-leaning policy with regards to Russia to deter Russian aggression. We were only going to be able to take half measures. And while I joined what was supposed to be a two-man team, there was no, you know, there was not going to be sufficient work. So what I did was I organized a Russia external policy. I mean, I basically took a lot of the things that I thought we needed to do with regards to Russia and looked to harden its neighbors against Russian malign influence. And, you know, Fiona and I had a good conversation on this, on what we could do that's not directly applicable to Russia. I had the wherewithal, you know, putting together the plans for the Department of Defense to do this. And I picked up it was a fateful decision to accept that, an expansion to my portfolio.
So it sounds like you were doing a lot more kind of foreign policy and national security work at the NSC. But one thing I was wondering while reading your book is your interactions with the State Department. You mentioned the firing of Ambassador Yovanovitch and as well as Gordon Sondland. But can you talk a little bit more about kind of how you shared information and coordinated with the State Department to improve the roles and relationships with Russia and Ukraine?
So this is the 2-minute version of the way the NSC operates. There are two fundamental models that are recognized for the State Department. There is one in which the I'm sorry for the National Security Council. There is one in which the power is kind of centralized in the National Security Council, and the National Security Council kind of develops and advocates for its own for ideas that it develops. And then there is the Scowcroft model, General Scowcroft, where it arbitrates between, fairly arbitrates between departments and agencies that develop their own policies for what within their own establishment authorities. I think during my tenure, I try to do a combination of both. The Security Council is National Security Council is uniquely positioned where it sits atop of all the departments and agencies. So it doesn't have a parochial view of, you know, State Department, doesn't have a parochial view of defense. It looks across them and looks to coordinate across them. So I think it's important sometimes, especially for complex challenges, to have something that, you know, that that is cross-cutting. And implied in that role is coordination across all the departments and agencies. So I had the authority as a director for the NSC to convene what are called, were at the time were called sub-policy coordinating committees. So I'm chairing a meeting with the deputy assistant secretaries of all the departments and agencies to develop policy for Ukraine. And then Fiona would be chairing the PCCs, the policy coordinating committees at the assistant secretary level, then the deputies, which is the number two folks, and then the principals. That's really the way it works. So I develop something and I push it up. Either I could execute it on my own authorities, meaning the authorities that are resident within departments and agencies, or it has to go further up the chain. And on several occasions, it did have to go significantly further up the chain.
Yeah, so someone who you had a working relationship with to improve relations with Russia, with Ukraine in the upcoming elections was Ambassador Marie Ivanovich. And there was quite a dramatic moment when she got recalled. And just for our audience, I guess, why do you think the Trump administration did that? And how common is it for an ambassador to get recalled from her post?
So it's might not be all that uncommon, but the way that this ambassador was recalled is, you know, potentially unprecedented. What ended up happening is that there was a effort by the Ukrainian government to end Rudy Giuliani, people in the president's inner circle, to cast Ambassador Ivanovich as a corrupt official. So, and this is all completely false, unsubstantiated, just nasty business. And the U.S. government does not remove an ambassador because some corrupt official in some other country, you know, wants to taint the ambassador. That just doesn't happen. Otherwise, we'd have all sorts of countries trying to do that. So it's a terribly bad precedent. In this case, it was, again, in cahoots with Trump's inner circle. Initially, it seemed like, you know, non-government officials. Later on, it was clear that government officials were drawn into this thing. And she was removed because she was seen as a potential obstacle to realizing this investigation into Joe Biden. That's primarily why. And that's from the U.S. side. From the Ukrainian side, it was much, much simpler. She was critical of a prosecutor general that was corrupt and that was not serving the role, and we were advocating for reforms and anti-corruption measures. So the synergies between different corrupt officials on the U.S. side and the Ukrainian side got together and came up with this plan to remove Ambassador Ivanovich, who's a great diplomat.
So let's move forward from there, because after she was removed, and you kept, of course, working to try to keep relations on track, and you were securing the election in Ukraine for the new president, and there was a new president elected, President Zelensky, and you actually got President Trump to do what I would call a normal congratulatory call with him. But then right after that call, which went exactly as you had planned it, things seemed to go off kilter. Things got strange, as you describe in your book. And the president changed plans about going to the inauguration of President Zelensky. He assigned the vice president, and then he forbid the vice president to go. And you ended up being the representative to go to the inauguration and to meet with all kinds of top officials. And you write that at that moment, you sort of knew that a network of people around the president, including Republicans in the legislative branch, were working on promoting these specious anti-Ukraine allegations. And I'd like to have you just very briefly talk about that, because we want to get into, of course, the July 25th phone call.
Sure. So what's important to realize is, you know, as I put in the book, is it wasn't just a single phone call. It was a whole series of events that unfolded over the previous months that I, as the responsible official, had been watching and reporting on, reporting to Fiona, reporting to John Bolton, the National Security Advisor. And you could definitely see a turning point as Biden, President, then Vice President Biden, became the front runner. And when he that's in 2019, that was before. But when he seriously was considering, you know, his campaign, and right about when he announces is when, you know, there's a switch flipped, and this whole enterprise that was kind of just generally unfolding. My understanding is that Rudy Giuliani was looking to help President Trump win a 2020 reelection, and foreseeing Vice President Biden as the primary opponent, was working on this enterprise. And then when Vice President Biden declared, Giuliani had Trump's attention and on this issue, and Trump's buy-in on this issue, and then Trump's complicity on this issue.
So let's go ahead with that. What happened after that phone call, particularly when you listened in on the July 25th, 2019 phone call? And Victor, why don't you ask some questions about that?
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously that moment was a pivotal one, not only in American history, but also yours, as it turned out. So I guess, yeah, like maybe tell our audience a little bit about how you prepared for this call on July 25th, 2019 at 9 a.m.
Yeah, so very quickly after the inauguration, we come back, and, you know, what we thought was a very successful visit was not perceived as such by the White House. It was an Oval Office visit that I was requested to attend to. I declined based on, you know, already these troubling indicators unfolding. And then shortly thereafter, there was a freeze on Ukrainian security assistance, nearly $400 million. And that was done through non-official channels. It was done through a process that, you know, didn't really make any sense. So I using this, the process I laid out to you earlier, I drew it into the national security process, and I convened these meetings and made sure that people were on the record, and that, you know, it couldn't just have been, it wasn't going to be something that remained in the dark. On July 10th, we had a visit from the Ukrainian National Security Advisor with the U.S. National Security Advisor. And that was the first time where, you know, rather than getting reports of Mick Mulvaney and, you know, other officials putting the freeze on Ukrainian security assistance, I heard firsthand Gordon Sondland say, in order to get a White House meeting, that President Zelensky had to deliver this investigation. And I immediately reported that to, I reported to the proper authorities, and Fiona and I had a couple of conversations about it. She also had a conversation with John Bolton. We were all pretty much on the same page. We were not going to participate in something like this. And then 2 weeks later was this congratulatory call that I prepared for, like I did the previous time. I put together all the background papers, the talking points, you know, it was supposed to be a congratulatory call. This was an unprecedented event in Ukraine where President Zelensky's brand new party that didn't exist months before won a majority, which was also unprecedented. Never had there been a party that won, you know, a majority in the parliamentary election. So should have been a no-brainer. But it turned out that, you know, the only reason that call landed was because Gordon Sondland connected with Mick Mulvaney and basically assured him that Zelensky was going to deliver an investigation, and that's why the president joined.
So I guess what was your reaction to President Trump asking President Zelensky to investigate not just any U.S. citizen, but the son of a major presidential candidate? And kind of walk us through maybe that process of like how did you feel afterward? You talked about reporting up the chain of command, but I mean, did you think it was a crime at the moment? Were you conflicted? What type of advice did you seek as you made that decision to report it up?
It was visceral and instantaneous. I understood immediately what the implications were. Domestically and overseas, I understood that, had Zelensky delivered on this, it would have broken U.S. support for Ukraine, which isn't altruistic. It's clearly, it's centrally in U.S. national security interests to have a strong Ukraine as a bulwark against Russian aggression. There's a famous quote by Zbigniew Brzezinski that about Russia with Ukraine automatically becoming an empire, absent and that was, these things all flashed through my mind, processed very, very quickly. And then the most important factor, of course, was the fact that the president was looking to tip the scales, impede free and fair elections. It was not an investigation into Hunter Biden. It was an investigation into Joe Biden that he was looking for. And I knew right away what I was going to do. I mean, there was no hesitation. I was going to report it to the proper authorities.
And so what happened, I guess, what did you think should happen? And then what happened afterward in reality after you reported that?
Well, what I was hoping it would happen is that these authorities would more senior officials with direct access to the president on a habitual basis, attorneys that could counsel him on the fact that what he was proposing was criminal, would go and say, Mr. President, you can't do this. I thought that could reverse the president made countless ill-considered decisions and reversed course on them. That's one thing that people don't recognize. He was constantly making mistakes and then having to undo those. He hated to do it publicly, but in this case, he wouldn't have to do it publicly. And I thought there was a good chance that, that if he received the counsel, he would reverse course. We'd lift the hold on security assistance. The Ukrainians might get their meetings and so forth, and support this president that was still in the midst of a war with the Russians and undertaking reforms and anti-corruption measures. What didn't happen is that didn't happen. The senior attorneys did not counsel the president, as far as I can tell, on his potentially criminal activity. And what ended up happening instead is in my coordinating role, I had a couple of conversations with folks, and I can't be definitive because I don't know if I was the sole reporting officer or if I was the person that kind of provided the information for the whistleblower complaint. But another individual made the righteous decision to recognize that this was not going to be corrected in house. I was trying to use the proper channels, using a military officer, using the chain of command, trying to fix it from the inside, from a pretty lofty position. I thought I could do something, and then the other individual, thought that was not going to be the case. They thought, there were no checks, nobody was going to take any actions on it, and proceeded to make a complaint that ultimately worked its way through Congress. So, in a way, the checks kind of worked. I did my job to a T. I reported it. I coordinated like I was supposed to. At the same time, somebody initiated a whistleblower complaint. And then while all that stuff was kind of easy, it was behind the scenes. Yes, I was taking some heat for it and being targeted for retaliation. But all that was behind closed doors. It wasn't until it became public. And then I knew that I was going to, stand by my position. I wasn't going to backpedal. I wasn't going to be kind of careerist or protect my own career, that I was going to provide testimony, full, complete testimony, that's when I took on much, much more significant risk.
So do you know who the whistleblower is?
I don't know who the whistleblower is. I mean, I could suspect who the whistleblower is.
I'll take your speculation.
No, but I mean, the interesting thing about this is, there's a cost to this. You can't just speculate and then be wrong and you know, upend somebody's life. This is the real world. I mean, could you imagine the catastrophe that would be? And especially if the fact that, you know, if I'm wrong. So I refuse to be speculative on this thing, and recognizing what I went through and putting that on somebody else. So
you're correct.
That's
obviously.
Right. But I think it's up to that person, you know, at some point to, you know, if they wish to share their story, you know, it would be interesting to hear what was going through their mind or so. But it's, you know, we'll see how that turns out.
But the result of it in any event was that there were several congressional committees that started investigating, and eventually the House Judiciary Committee had a formal impeachment inquiry, and they did vote two articles of impeachment, but of course we know President Trump was acquitted by the Senate on a straight party line vote. You were one of the witnesses before the closed door session investigation, well, as
correct,
well as
Mitt Romney.
You're right. You're right. Mitt Romney,
which is unprecedented. Yeah, I knew he was going to do that. Frankly, I don't remember if it's actually in the book, but I remember bumping into him outside of the West Wing and having a conversation with him, and you know, just having a conversation about, like, you know, moral courage and doing the right thing. And I had every belief at that point that he was going to do the right thing.
Okay, so. You're right, of course, that it was the one lone vote on one of the articles of impeachment. And I want to talk to you about what it was like as you were sitting in front of Congress, a lieutenant colonel testifying against the president. But before we ask you how it felt to do that, I want to talk about how you prepared to be there. And I don't mean just your life of service and your life of training, but specifically, what did you do to prepare to be in that testimonial position?
So I retained counsel. I go through in the book about how I did that, and yeah. Some thoughts to selecting Republican stalwarts to ensure that I know the White House wasn't going to, you know, come after me and target me immediately. So I was thoughtful about doing that. I did I did kind of relatively standard preparation. I talked about this in the book also. You know, attorneys want to go over each question and rehearse each answer. And that's not the way I work. That's not the way my mind works. And, you know, they figured out pretty quickly that I didn't need that kind of prep. I also recognized that I didn't need that kind of prep because I was just being truthful and I didn't have to keep a story straight. So we still, you know, still kind of went through the different possibilities and the different kinds of questions and stuff like that. And rather than kind of rehearsing answers, I just, you know, it was a way to think through the different possibilities. And then... ultimately, I was called to testify in a closed door hearing on October 29th, and that went, you know, that was the first time I'd done anything quite like that. Probably a tiny bit more nerve wracking, although I think as time wore on, I eased into it, and maybe the other side was getting a little bit flustered because they couldn't really, you know. They couldn't impugn my integrity so much. They couldn't deal with the facts. They could make process arguments about, you know, the why the Democrats were conducting these hearings and stuff like that. And then, you know, a couple weeks later or so, I had the public testimony, at which point, you know, I became a public figure.
So you described the closed door hearings as really worse than your public testimony, that it was so partisan. Can you describe that, what you mean by that?
Yeah. So, I had come into maybe a little bit naively into this with, you know, the expectation that, yes, the Republicans are going to try to cast the situation in a friendly light to the president, and the Democrats are going to pursue pursue evidence, attempt to get straight answers to what had unfolded with regards to the phone call and so forth. But I didn't necessarily expect kind of the really harsh treatment by Republicans that in fact, you know, tended to portray themselves as friends of the military, friends of public servants and things of that nature. So that was something that I, you know, just wasn't necessarily prepared for, like, you know, smiling, grinning remarks by Republicans that, you know, were disingenuous and stuff like that, like Cheshire Cat or something like that. But anyway, I definitely felt myself kind of ease into it once I got my bearings, going back to the navigation, metaphor, I got my bearings and, it wasn't really all that hard because, you know, when somebody would say something, I wasn't looking to cater to either side. I was going to be, full throated and truthful. But, you know, when somebody made some sort of ridiculous claim about something, I could expound ad nauseum about the reality of the geopolitics or about the national security issue or about what's going on in Ukraine. When somebody said something about, like, you know, about Burisma, this firm that Hunter Biden worked for, I could, you know, just punch through that kind of the rhetoric or about investigations or about the personalities because I'd been working these issues and studied it and, you know. They just were not prepared for that, I don't think.
Well, I'd recommend that people read your book because I think your description of being in that closed door hearing is really quite dramatic and also shows how analytic you are and how you were able to sort of take what you were doing to try to figure out where was the questioner really going so that he wouldn't lead you into a trap, which is partly based on, I think, your military training. But after it was over, after the public testimony, and you're becoming quite a well-known figure, it had a big impact on you. It had a big impact on your career. It had a big impact on your family. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about whether, you know, your relationship with your father, who was opposed to your coming forward for a variety of reasons, and maybe your most dramatic testimony was your opening in which you describe how in America this is the right thing to do. But I'm wondering if there was any special problems with your family particularly. I mean, your brother had always been very close with you. Now you were a superstar. Did that have any, you know, impact on your relationship with him? Talk about the more personal stuff.
Sure. Sure. So, of course, there was, an enormous amount of upheaval. I think something that people don't recognize about, like, whistleblowers that do the right thing, somehow, like, the clouds part and, you know, the sun's shining or something like that, like, you know, yeah. From Hollywood. And it's not the way it happens. I mean, there is I frankly was well positioned to land on my feet in certain ways because I had a track record of successes and, you know, degrees and all that kind of stuff and a network that I could fall back on. But that's not necessarily the case with whistleblowers. With regards to the question about my father, he was speaking from a place of love and care for me. And his concerns were that I was going to upend my life. And he didn't understand all the kind of the details or what was at stake. So his counsel was to, you know, try to reconcile with the president. But again, that was from a place of, because I couldn't talk to him. It was classified at the time. So he was just giving it general counsel. And also he didn't believe that the president would be that corrupt. He was, he had voted for Trump in 2016. And, he had thought that this would be a good outsider that could shake things up or something like that. Once the facts became clear, of course, there was no question about where this is not one of those stories about families being torn apart. I had the devotion of my father. Same thing with my other family members that, you know, they were concerned about my how things might settle out with my life and career, and they were urged caution, and I weighed all that, and then just kind of like I point out in the book, I took my own counsel. I had to ultimately have to live with the decisions, and my family might describe that as stubborn. My twin brother, you know, who's I'm very, very close with. I'm close with my wife and my daughter. I'm close with my twin brother. You know, it's a little bit tough, and I try to pull him into as much stuff as possible. And you know, we were always like neck and neck on everything that we did. And now I have this like massive public presence, so it's a little bit tough. And I'm thoughtful of that and try to keep him included and you know, not like the typical kind of giving him a hard time stuff, because yeah, he's facing challenges too as a result of this. And he doesn't get any of the accolades. Yeah, he doesn't get any of the accolades. He deserves them.
Yes, and for those who don't know, not only were you fired in retaliation for having come forward, but so was he. So that's just something
now,
our audience needs.
He's
to know.
Now wrapping up his military career, also, frankly, because he's facing the same headwinds. Even though he's promoted to colonel, he's frankly facing the same headwinds I did. Recognizing that the military was conservative, I became radioactive, and the military didn't want me, no matter how capable I was, because of it. Because of concerns that they would be considered partisan, or I would reflect on their kind of commands and leadership. So I found no possibility of staying on after, to my wife's chagrin, an exhaustive period of review. So it was, yeah, it was, he's unfortunately wrapping up his military career also.
Sorry about that.
I mean, your life trajectory has just been so inspiring, and I think a model for anyone who wants to get involved and kind of find their way in public service and in public service and politics. And I'm wondering if you have any plans beyond what you're doing now after you earn your doctorate. What's in store for you?
So I've got like five or six jobs of different kinds at the moment, partially because I haven't quite figured out what I want to do. I knew that I could still contribute to national security and the dialogue around national security. I could, frankly, now with a public voice, contribute to holding accountable leaders that fall short of their obligations to their oaths or to institutional values. I could advocate for public servants, so I'm doing that. Working on a doctorate at Johns Hopkins. Writing on great power competition, writing on the impact of Russia, Ukraine on U.S. foreign policy. You mentioned in the intro the various other things I'm doing. I think the Renewed Democracy effort that I'm a part of is really key because of the nature of our political environment and how polarized it is, looking for solutions to these vexing issues. Teaching is a possibility. Maybe there's another stint in government somewhere along the way. Who knows? That's a possibility. I'm looking to find my footing to figure out what it is I want to do over the long term.
When you mention a possibility of going back to government, I'm just wondering, is there anything that the current administration could do to rectify the wrong? You were on the promotion list to colonel and would certainly have been promoted had it not been for this retaliation. And I'm wondering if there's some way that you could get that promotion and come back to government. Is there anything that can be done about that?
You know, I find that hard to imagine. The Biden administration has a full plate of a policy agenda that they want to fulfill, that they want to deliver based on the platform, a whole host of crises, and an unaddressed issue with regards to accountability from the previous administration. I think you know, little old Alex Vindman doesn't fit into that calculus.
Well, given everything you have done in service to this country, and you do describe an outpouring of support from ordinary Americans following your testimony, as well as the ugliness from the right-wing media, but I'm hoping that you will remember only the good things and the outpouring of support that you got, rather than the ugliness. And we know you're going to succeed in whatever you do next. So good luck to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation.
I hope you all enjoyed our conversation with Colonel Alexander Vindman as much as I did, and that you'll come back again next week for another episode of iGen Politics. Thank you for being with us.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.